Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Jerome Charon, author of the new book, Maria La Divina. Maria Callas, called La Divina, is widely recognized as the greatest operatic diva who ever lived. Jerome Charon's Callas springs to life as the headstrong, mercurial, and charismatic artist who captivated generations of fans, thrilling audiences with her brilliant performances and defiant personality. Callas, an outsider from an impoverished background, was shunned by the Italian opera houses, but through sheer force of will and power and range of her voice, she broke through the invisible wall to sing at La Scala and headlined at the Metropolitan Opera, forging an unforgettable career. Jerome Charon is the award-winning author of more than 50 works of fiction and nonfiction, including Maria de la Divina, Ravaging Sun, Sergeant Salinger, Cesare, a novel of war-torn Berlin, In the Shadow of King Saul, Essays on Silence and Song, Jersey, a novel, and A Loaded Gun, Emily Dickinson for the 21st Century. He lives in Manhattan, joins us from his home in Manhattan. Jerome Charon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you on. So before we jump into Maria Callas, this iconic figure, tell me a little bit about yourself. You, I think, like Maria Callas, were, I don't know if you were born in the Bronx, raised in the Bronx?
I was born in the Bronx among great poverty. That's why I felt so compelled towards her. We were very, very poor, but in the old days when college tuition wasn't $65,000, I went to a very fine school, Columbia College, and that education defined my life. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a writer, and that the writing had nothing to do with earning a living. You are an apprentice all your life. You're learning. I'm 88 years old. I'm still learning. I still feel like a kid. When I go in front of the screen, I'm a child learning how to write. Mm.
Now, you do mostly, and this book is a novel, right? Historical fiction. Why do you choose to do it that way?
I've done detective novels. I've done I like to get inside the heart of a historical person. I've done novels on Lincoln, on Emily Dickinson, on Orson Welles. I feel comfortable in that particular zone. And I happened to see a documentary about Maria Callas called Maria by Callas. And I felt, I'm this person, I am her. I mean, I felt completely united with her. And I dove into the research and you can never tell whether a novel will form or not. You know, it's a fabric. It's like sewing. You know, will the sweater exist? So I tried, and I began with Madame Hidalgo, her teacher, in Athens. And the novel, over a series of years, came together. It was very hard work.
Yeah, it's a big life. And You capture that with some captivating scenes. Let's hear some Maria Callas. I'll alert you, yeah. Mr. Charon, that with our technical setup, you may or may not be able to hear this. I hope you will, but our audience will. Of course, you know what Maria Callas sounds like. Some of our audience may not, and they may be wondering, well, what's all the shouting about? Well, right. Here, let's give you a little taste. This is from Jacopo Puccini's opera Tosca. And the character here is singing an aria called Vici d'arte, Vici d'arte et Vici d'amore. I've lived for art. I've lived for love. Which, I think epitomizes Callas herself. So let's hear Maria Callas's actual voice talent here.
Thank you.
So there's Vici d'arte, Vici d'amor. You know, the listeners will hear the power in the voice, right? The force of personality. There's a lot of callus right there in her voice.
And the range of her voice. I mean, she had most people don't see it as a beautiful voice, but it was a powerful voice, and it was a voice full of emotion and of life. And there was no other singer of her time or of any time who could match the intensity of what she sang and how she sang and what she felt when she sang. It's very important. She was completely immersed in the role, and it's unforgettable. If you hear the Castadiva from Norma, you just can't forget it.
Yeah, we'll hear that a little later in the program, that particular one. So let's take listeners to the first scene in the book. You begin with a bang here. This is Callus's mother has taken her and her, is it her brother or sister?
Her sister.
So they're of Greek descent, but Callus has grown up to that point in the Bronx. But the mother takes him to Athens and to a famous soprano, Elvira Hidalgo. Tell us about that scene. Hidalgo first dismisses her, but then hears her sing, right?
Well, Hidalgo sees this chubby girl in sandals and wonders why she's bothered to come. She doesn't have the aura, the feeling of the look of a singer, but when Madame Hidalgo hears her voice, the power of her voice, she starts to cry, and she says, at last, there's a reason for me to be at Athens. This young girl is a singer.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you get a flavor of, you know, the daughter and the mother. The Hidalgo dismisses mom.
Yes.
And Maria says, well, you're going to have trouble dismissing her permanently, right?
Right.
The mother is kind of a force of nature, right?
She is a force of nature. And you could both say that she made Maria's life and ruined it at the same time. And it's a very, very sad tale. And you could do an opera on that story. But at the end of her life, Maria did not grieve for the loss of her mother.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it may be a stereotypical stage mother. She had a lot of ambition for her daughter, I guess.
She was not, you could say she was a typical stage mother, but she was also insane. So that added to the problem. I mean, she had illusions about her becoming, you know, a great impresario, and It really helped Maria at first, got her started, but then it really began to hurt her.
Yeah. So let's go back to the
also, yeah, she was a collaborator with the Germans during the war.
Oh, she was.
Yes, which is not a, she had an Italian boyfriend, lover, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So the mother, she had a son previously, right, who died,
who died, Vasily, who died, a very blonde angel was her angel, and she felt that her life ended at that point. Her husband was a druggist, you know, had his own pharmacy, but he made the decision to move to America, so they moved to sort of Little Athens, which is Astoria in Queens, and they lived there for a while, and then they moved to Washington Heights in Manhattan, where I also lived.
Yeah, yeah. So you have that connection. You said when you watched that documentary, you felt, oh, that's me. What? Tell me a little bit more about that. What is the connection?
Well, I saw a woman who had a certain power, a certain resonance, but wasn't absolutely sure of herself. And she moved me deeply. It was unforgettable. I told my wife, and I don't know, maybe it's a very bad thing to say is that I wanted to divorce her and marry a dead woman. But of course, I did not want to divorce my wife, and I would not have married a dead woman, but that's exactly the way I felt. I fell in love with her. You know, there was something that touched me, and maybe other people didn't see it. Maybe other people didn't see her vulnerability because, you know, she spoke with a Bronx accent, and yet when, you know, she was in an interview, her tonality was different. It was perfect. So you see, she was a kind of monster, but a beautiful monster, and someone that I wanted to spend part of my life with. I married her through writing about her.
Yes, I was just pulled up an interview with her yesterday. And in interviews, it's a very cultured accent, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But if you spoke to her, she spoke like a truck driver.
Oh, she did. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. She could, and not only that, she fought with her fists.
Yeah, oh, really?
Men, mm-hmm. You know, and beat them up.
Yeah. I'm sure there, you know, many fell in love with her when she was on the stage, right? I think whether or not they saw her vulnerability. But she seemed to have crafted this persona. How did she do that?
Well, that was difficult for her because remember, she weighed over 200 pounds at the beginning of her career and she was not really attractive. But in 1953, she saw a film with Audrey Hepburn and she was mesmerized by her. And she wanted to be Audrey Hepburn. So she went through a series of diets and did very strange things, but she lost over 80 pounds in about a year. And this was talked about in Italy. This became the news, you know, all the gossip. And people said that she would lose her voice through all that, you know, sudden loss of weight. But she, not only did she not lose her voice, she sang just as well, and suddenly the beast became the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, you know, all the fashion designers wanted to model clothes for her, and she was in every magazine, and she was a completely different woman, and she was beautiful. And because she had such intensity, you really couldn't take your eyes off her. She had that quality.
Is that force of will that's just part of her personality, that intensity? It just comes with her? Did she develop that?
Well, you said it. She lived for her art. She lived for love. She lived for art. And her love was her art until she fell in love with Aristotle Onassis. She had a striking personality and also you have to understand she was unlike most of the singers. First of all, she was half blind, so she couldn't sing the stage. She couldn't see the stage. She had to mark the various parts of the stage so she knew where to go, and so she, you know, she and also during every rehearsal, she was the only singer who sang in full voice, which is why she lost her voice at a very early age. So every stage rehearsal was a performance, and every stage rehearsal was different. She was unlike every other singer who has ever lived and who will ever live.
Mm-hmm. Let's take you back to Athens. Madame Hidalgo takes her on and trains her.
Right.
I think she gets on the stage in Athens, right? But that's too small of an arena. She wants to hit the big time, I think.
It's not only that. There was politics involved with the National Opera because they felt that her family had collaborated with the Italians mm-hmm. and the Germans. But she did sing Norma in Greece, and she became a star, a young star. But after the war was over, I mean, she was hated by the government, and they wouldn't let her. They wouldn't let her sing, so she had no choice. Madame Hidalgo said she should go to Italy where she could have a career. Well, that wasn't really possible because the Italians didn't really like her. So she went back to the United States and finally went to Italy, and where she met her husband, Tita, and he helped her have a career. Without him as her stage manager, she would not have had a career. So it's always difficult for an opera singer to find the audience, to find the locale. And remember, she was a foreigner at La Scala, and for a foreigner to sing at La Scala is very, very difficult.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll talk about that, how she conquered, finally, La Scala and New York, right, and the world. It was a whole process. Brought back a whole genre of music, right, bel canto, that had been been neglected as well. We'll talk a bit more about her artistry and her personality, and it, of course, there's much more. We're talking with Jerome Charon, author of Maria la Divina. We're talking about Maria Callas, called La Divina, widely recognized as the greatest operatic diva who ever lived. Jerome Charon has captured her life in this historical novel called Maria la Divina. More following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Jerome Charon. He's author of award-winning author, more than 50 works of fiction and nonfiction. The latest book is called Maria la Divina, and it's about Maria Callas, who is called La Divina, widely recognized as the greatest operatic diva who ever lived. Jerome Charon has captured her life in this book. So let's hear a little bit more of Maria Callas. I want to have people hear her singing. Hear this great power of her voice. You mentioned Jerome Charon, Casta Diva. Let's hear. We'll hear a bit of that great aria. This is from that bel canto period, right? Vincenzo Bellini that we're talking about. Maria Callas helped to bring that back after it had been neglected. So here's just a portion of the famous aria from Norma. It's called Casta Diva. So yeah, I'd like to just play a bunch more of that. The voice is incredible, not perfect, right? It's kind of a hooded quality to it, and you didn't really hear it in this selection, but especially as she went along in her career, there's kind of a wobble, kind of an exaggerated vibrato.
Wobble. Because she could go from one range to the other. But one reason why this aria is unique is that Norma is a high priestess of the Gauls, and the Gauls are at war with the Romans, and her lover is the Roman consul, and she's had two children with the consul. So she's singing to, you know, to the gods of Gaul, you know, about going to war, so that the entire aria is a kind of lie. And you can feel it as she sings that there's such sadness and such despair. There's nothing like it. It's the perfect example of bel canto, which is measured singing, which is not only beautiful, but has a kind of purity. And you no longer, we no longer have this facility, this kind of ability to sing the way Maria Callas sang. But I think it's, I always weep when I hear this aria. It just moves me because it has such enormous power and depth. And I hope you liked it also.
Definitely. Bellini famously said he wanted people to weep, shudder, and die through music, and we certainly do, right? Yeah.
But let's stop there. That's exactly what I want the reader to do when they read
Ah,
my book.
yes.
It's to weep, cry, and
Yeah.
die.
Yeah, here it is.
Right.
Maria La
The
Divina.
famous canary.
Yes. They're the canaries. Tell me about that. The canaries were important
Yes,
with Callas.
her father gave her the three canaries, and she would often two male and one female, and she would often sing to the canaries, and of course they would sing back. So it was very important to her, and of course the title of the first chapter where she's in Greece is The Lone Canary, because that's what she became. She was very isolated. You have to remember that a singer of her stature basically has to be alone to prepare to she went up to the roof of her building and plotted out the stage where she would be singing, because she couldn't see the stage. And not only that, she couldn't see the audience when they cheered her, so that added to the intensity of her voice and the power of what she was able to do.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's one more hurdle, right? She couldn't,
Yes.
she'd have to block out
Couldn't
because she
see,
couldn't see the stage. Yeah.
She never saw the audience.
Yeah. Tell me about that. Some of that isolation was self-inflicted, wasn't it? Especially with regard to her family.
Yes, she did not get along with her family, but you have to remember that she had a certain temperament. She was a prima donna. She was a diva, and that's what a diva is. And a diva, acts in a way that other singers don't. And of course, her mother first tried to install her older sister, Jackie, as a singer. You remember, I'm old enough to recall Diana Durbin, who was a great star of the late 30s and early 40s, and she was
Right.
a singer. And every young girl in America wanted to be Diana Durbin. And Maria didn't want to be Diana Durbin because Diana Durbin was not a great singer.
Right.
On the other hand,
Yeah.
it's hard to say, was it ambition? No, it was devotion to her craft. It was the belief in the power of the music. And I think if you look at her life, she only became alive on the stage. When she was off the stage, she was not alive.
How did it, especially seeing interviews with her, you can kind of, definitely through her music, you can get a bit of her personality. She's a very strong personality, obviously, strong-willed,
Yes.
doesn't seem to suffer fools gladly. I wonder how she got along with colleagues who, fellow singers who she felt were
She
not up to
didn't.
snuff.
She didn't get along. As a matter of fact, when she first sang, first of all, Rudolph Bing hated her, but he knew that if he didn't have Maria Callas, he would lose out. You have to remember, she was the only singer who was larger than any other opera house. In other words, she was larger than the Met, she was larger than La Scala, she was more important. So when Rudolph Bing finally, agreed to have her sing, he paid her off in pennies. Her fee was very, very high. And so he just threw a sack of pennies at her, and she threw it right back and slashed her face. She was very, very temperamental and very violent. And there's violence in her singing, violence in her personality, and a great deal of love also.
I mean, she's widely regarded as the greatest singing actress, right?
Yes, she was a great actress.
You feel the character. You don't even have to see her, right? You can hear it.
Right.
But you always hear Callas herself as well in there, right? It's part of her arc.
Yes, you do, but she becomes the role, and also remember, her only life, her real life, is on the stage. So you're seeing someone who's not only performing, but is living out the role in a way that no other opera singer or no other, actor could ever do. I would compare her to Marlon Brando in a way, who also had this kind of brilliance, who became the role, and he would be a male diva, which means that you can't get along with that person. That person is impossible. And also, what's very important is she wasn't educated. She had no education at all. She loved to see westerns. That was her favorite form of entertainment, and also to read gossip columns. She had never read a book in her life, and yet she had such education in her voice. When she was asked, "Well, you're going to play a queen in Anna Bolena," she said, "I know, you have to read this book, read that book, Joe's book about the king of this or queen of that." And she simply said, "I know how to be a queen." And she did.
She had it inside her. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So she finally, with the help of her husband, conquered La Scala, right? And you said Rudolph Bing hated her, but he realized I gotta put her on the mat, right?
Right.
I want to turn a bit to more of her personal life. How did she meet Aristotle Onassis? This was the love of her life, I guess, right?
Yes, this was at a party, and they were the two most famous Greeks. Of course, he was a womanizer, and she was faithful to her husband, though she did have one or two lovers, including Visconti. But he pursued her, and she fell in love with him, and she was starved for love. And when she fell in love with Onassis, she didn't want to sing anymore. She had no reason to sing. I mean, her life was with him. And of course, he famously betrayed her and married Jackie Kennedy.
So that must have been incredibly devastating.
Oh, it ruined her life. She had no life after that. But of course, Onassis, after a month or two, began to court her again, because Jackie, as great as she was really a piece of cake. So he always crawled back to her, and at first she didn't accept him, but later on she did, and they became lovers again. But he had myasthenia gravis. He had a nerve disease that finally killed him. And when he died, I mean, she died with him. Really, it was an opera. It's an opera that maybe I will write. Is that love story?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You can help me with it.
Love to hear that opera. Yes.
I will do it. I will do it. It's a great idea. You know what? Take down the notes.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, Callas, her whole life is operatic, right?
Yes, she had an operatic life, which made her. But the thing is, her operatic life was genuine, which is why she was the diva of divas. In that the life she lived off stage and on stage was exactly the same. She was. I mean, you could use the cliche larger than life, but that doesn't really apply to her, because she was also very moving. She was a creature that I fell in love with and am still in love with.
Did she ever interact with Jackie Kennedy, her rival?
Yes, they met she gave music lessons at Juilliard. You know, she taught a master class at Juilliard, and a play was made, you know, out of those particular classes. But I found them very interesting, because it was at a time when her voice, you know, she was losing the tonality of her voice, but she sang along with her students. And she did meet Jackie Kennedy, who attended some of the master classes, and Jackie Kennedy was awed by her. I mean, found her, you know, a very cultivated woman who understood Maria Callas's strengths, and she was a great teacher also. I mean, that's what's interesting. It's never been emphasized, but she was a wonderful teacher of music, and those master classes are unforgettable, and they're a big part of the book.
Yeah, the kind of famous, right? Became more famous as she went
they're
along.
Mythical. There's no other teacher who had the same kind of dimension. We don't think of, we think of great teachers, but these master classes were unique, and she devoted all her time to them and really worked so hard with her students.
Obviously, I guess if Maria Callas is going to teach a class, you're gonna go. But is it? I guess she's regarded as having technical mastery, understanding, intimate understanding of the craft. But part of it's probably her personality as well, right?
It's her personality. It's also bel canto. It's many things. But the thing is that, you know, if you think of her as a person learning her craft, she was able to sort of share her craft with her students. Now, I'm not aware that any of her students went on to become famous opera singers, but that doesn't really matter. I mean, they were master classes given by a master in front of an entire audience. I mean, it was like a stage performance. I mean, all of the famous opera singers were there, movie stars were there, because they wanted to see this very perverse and strange woman who sat there and was totally serious in what she was doing. Remember, seriousness is a very important quality. Everything she did was absolutely serious, and that's why she's so great.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Jerome Charon. The book is Maria La Divina, a novel of Maria Callas. And we're talking about that. That's out and available now, and well worth the read. We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Jerome Charon, author of many award-winning books. The latest is on Maria Callas. It's called Maria La Divina, a novel of Maria Callas. That's out and available now. A great read. So let's hear some more Callas. This is from Catalani's La Wali. And this aria is Eben Neandro Lontana. Well, then I shall go far away. Ari describes the Wally's desire to leave her home and family, imagining herself going to a distant, solitary place among snowy mountains and golden clouds, far from the pain and regret of her life. Let's just hear the end of this aria. So I don't know. It's just about any aria or operatic character you pick, you see parallels with Callas's life, right? And in this case, she's going to go away, going to be solitary, which was strained throughout her life, right? But especially when her voice went, right? She went to Paris.
Onassis bought her an apartment on the Avenue Georges Mandel. In the 16th arrondissement. And it's interesting, when I lived in Paris, I passed under that building many times, not knowing that Maria Callas had lived there. But she was very isolated, very, very alone without Onassis. She lived alone, she sang alone, she died alone. And that, you know, it's tragic, but when you think of the beauty she gave us, it's not for us to say that it was worth her suffering. But you could see, you know, there's very little joy in the music. It's mostly about a kind of sadness, and she's able to offer that kind. It's the sadness of life. It's the sadness of loss. And she's the queen of sadness in a way. And it still moves us, even if a younger generation has forgotten who she is. And if you hear Casta Diva, you just can't forget it.
So there's and especially as years go on, right, there's Callas the icon, right?
Right.
The popular persona, and then the Callas the person. How are those similar, and how are those different?
Well, Callas the person didn't really exist, because, as I said, she had no interest outside of the opera and her two pet poodles. She didn't read. She wasn't interested in politics. She watched Westerns all day, and she had phlebitis. She had a very bad problems with her legs, and this is what eventually killed her. So that she really came alive on stage, and this is what you notice. And when you see a great performance, it's not only Callas. It's a performance where the person is sort of dying on stage as they perform, or as they sing, because they're giving so much of herself. She gave everything. There was nothing left for her, so she was completely exhausted after each performance. And when she lost her voice once at one of the Roman opera houses, the audience was very, very angry, but she had been ill, she had bronchitis, and she couldn't sing, and the Italians wouldn't forgive her. She really had to sort of move away from her house in Milan and go to the country. She was alone. That's the primary factor of a diva. The diva is always alone.
That isolation, there's a power in that too, right? I guess
Yes.
that fed into her art.
Yes. And so that when she sang, she gave you everything. When she was Violetta, who was a sort of a reformed prostitute, you feel so much emotion, and audiences loved her. I mean, they couldn't get enough of her.
Speaking back to the kind of the popular conception of Maria, what there was a film, right, starring Angelina Jolie. What did you think of that?
Terrible. It really was misleading because it didn't show. I don't know if it was Angelina Jolie's fault. I mean, but you would have had to have shown the love affair with Aristotle Onassis for the film to make any sense, because you don't really understand. She's lost her voice, but she's lost Onassis, and you could have had a wonderful scene at the American hospital when she goes to visit him, and he made a famous remark about her. She said, "You're only a woman who's lost her whistle," meaning she's lost her voice. And there she sort of whistled to him. I mean, I could write that opera. The opera writes itself. I don't have to write it. So where is it?
Well, I guess that'll be next, maybe. Yeah.
I hope so. I'm going to
Yeah.
try.
Yeah.
I'm
Yeah.
going to try to get Lady Gaga to play her.
Oh, she'd be great, wouldn't she? She'd be excellent.
She would be wonderful.
Yeah. What is Callas's legacy?
Well, that's difficult to say. I hope I will be part of this legacy. In other words, I hope that people, and also there's an audio book that was prepared by my stepdaughter, who's a famous soap opera star, Eden Riegel, and I wanted her to do the audio book, and she did, and I hope audiences will enjoy it. But what is a writer's legacy or a singer's legacy is that I wanted to write this book so that people would remember her and remember the power that she had. And so I hope that Eden in the audio book will move readers to go back and think of Maria Callas.
Yeah, that these days that's really important, isn't it? Who does your who reads the audio version of your book, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
most people aren't reading it. You know yourself, people don't read novels. So you're already sitting here with someone who doesn't no longer exist, but I still get pleasure out of writing the novels. And I think the audiobooks will remain, because people are lazy. They will sit in their cars and they'll listen to a story. People love stories. They just don't want to take the time to read.
So you spent what 3 years or something with Maria Callas, right? In a
But
sense, or
not only 3 years, 3 total years, remember, from morning to night. I'm always working. And my wife is, I don't know whether she's happy or unhappy about my working, but she understands the quality of the work, and I couldn't have done it without her, because she's been so helpful, and she's a problem solver. I'm a
Yeah.
problem maker, and she's a problem solver.
You make a good team then. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I guess I was going to ask you, you spend, for example, you did a book on Emily Dickinson, spent some time with her, many of these figures. It's hard to put that aside when you go to the next
Well, there
book.
is a there, Emily Dickinson was also a diva. She was a hidden diva. I mean, she had a tremendous strength. No one knew that she was writing poems, but She was very powerful in her pursuit of writing, and as Maria Callas was powerful in her pursuit of singing. So one could make a comparison between them, even though one was a poet and one was an artist. But I liked to deal, I don't know why, I love to deal with strong women, with women who have a kind of strength, because maybe my mother had that strength, or I don't know. I just feel drawn to to women like that. So I've written about, maybe my next novel will be about Dostoevsky's second wife, who really created him as an author and created a publishing house for him. But I'm attracted to women like that.
Well, yeah, I'll read that one. That's I hadn't known about that, Dostoevsky's Second Wife. Well, we reached the end of our time. The book is Maria La Divina, and it's about Maria Callas, novel Maria Callas, and the author is Jerome Charon. He's joined us for the hour. Jerome Charon, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom, and good luck with everything.
You too. We'll look forward to your next book. And people go out and get this one. And thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.